Today is Monday, May 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Medical professionals continue warning against taking unproven medications to fight COVID-19.
They can be potentially cardiotoxic at very high doses, and for people with pre-existing conditions, there are additional risks.
Plus, what are the psychological impacts of extended stay-at-home orders? And why is it so hard to get good information on North Korea?
When I was in the CIA, we referred to North Korea as the hardest of the hard targets.
Those stories and more next. New Zealand reported zero new coronavirus cases Monday for the first time since the middle of March. The milestone comes a week after the country began loosening strict lockdown rules in place for a month as the government sought to stop the spread of the virus. While New Zealand has made significant progress against the virus with about 1,500 total confirmed cases and 20 deaths, it is taking a cautious approach to reversing the stay-at-home measures. Most schools are still closed, as are most shops and restaurants. In Europe, Italy, one of the hardest hit nations, began the process of reopening Monday with factory and construction workers allowed to return to their jobs. People also will be allowed to take walks and visit relatives, while restaurants will be allowed to provide takeaway service. In Spain, commuters using public transportation were required to wear masks on Monday, on the first day of its easing of lockdown measures. In Asia, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced he was extending Japan's state of emergency to the end of the month. India's six-week coronavirus lockdown, which was supposed to end today, has been extended for two more weeks, with a few relaxations, such as construction resuming and self-employed people returning to work in New Delhi. There are more than 3.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 worldwide, with nearly 250,000 deaths. Health officials have cautioned against reopening too quickly and risking a new wave of infections, the reverse progress being made in recent weeks in areas under the lockdown. Researchers throughout the world are also searching for remedies to treat COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus. There are some drugs that show promise, however, fears among the public can lead to searches for unproven therapies. VOA's Carol Pearson takes things from here.
A drug called chloroquine, and some people would add to it hydroxychloroquine.
In mid-March, President Trump touted drugs used to treat malaria as a remedy for COVID-19.
Based on what I see, it could be a game changer.
And even though there was no proof that it worked for patients stricken by the virus, the president continued to promote the drugs.
I've seen people that are going to die without it. And you know the expression, when that's happening, they should do it. What really do we have to lose?
Michael Liu is a researcher at Oxford University. He says improper use of these powerful drugs can be hazardous.
They can be potentially cardiotoxic at very high doses. And for people with pre-existing conditions, there are additional risks that come along with these two drugs. And so they should be taken under medical supervision.
A new study published in JAMA, Internal Medicine, found that internet searches by people who wanted to buy these drugs jumped by nearly 1,400% after President Trump recommended them. Liu was the lead author.
Instead of just looking at search trends that were indicative of people just Googling and kind of learning more about these drugs, we specifically looked at people seeking out to buy or order these drugs in addition to kind of using these terms in addition to these e-commerce websites.
Disinfectants are hard to find in the stores, but calls to the CDC, poison control centers, and state departments of health increased after Mr. Trump said that injecting disinfectants might also work to treat COVID-19. Both manufacturers and doctors, like Dr. Oxiris Barbeau, the New York City Health Commissioner, warned the public not to try it.
Introducing one of these products in any way, shape, or form, be it by injection, ingestion, or application on the skin, is harming the body.
What the study suggests is that statements from political leaders influence people's actions, and misinformation can have harmful or even deadly results. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month in the United States and comes as much of the world has been under lockdown to varying degrees for more than a month. As discussions in the United States takes place on when to relax stay-at-home guidelines, other countries have already started the process. Stacey Hansen is a licensed clinical social worker and community outreach coordinator for the RecoveryVillage.com in Orlando, Florida. I spoke with her via Skype about the psychological impact of self-isolation.
I think isolation can cause a number of, I guess, particular issues to increase or lessen for people. We've talked about the extrovert versus the introvert before, but when we look at isolation, we look at what has changed for people. How does that impact how they've typically lived their lives? And most of us get supports outside of the home, right? And when we look at Mental Health Awareness Month, we look at what's now absent that used to be present. So whether that's support groups, whether that's going to the therapist or your physician, whether that's accessing coping skills like going to the gym, right, or going on walks and being social with friends. You know, there's things that have been removed from our normal day-to-day coping that I think is starting to have a compounded impact on us.
So what are the things that, you know, people are starting to face? And what challenges are they facing? And I guess, you know, what are some methods that they can use to overcome them?
Obviously, we look at the compounding mental health issues with that as well. But we look at the isolation causes potentially boredom. We see that people get bored. They aren't sure how to fill their time. Sometimes boredom leads to unhealthy habits or tapping into old habits that are not the best for us, whether that's looking at, addiction type things, eating habits that may change, getting into family dynamics and emotional conflicts that may worsen the situation. We're looking at things just almost fueling the fire of whatever was there before. So we have the boredom factor. I mean, there's only so much screen time somebody can stand, right? And we look at how those components can be helpful. Getting that information in is tremendously helpful. Information is one of the things that can help people get through an isolative period like this, knowing what's going on, right? Because we're so disconnected in many ways, but we can stay connected through media, whether that's, you know, listening to programs like this, whether that's tapping into podcasts, whether that's reading the news, whether that's connecting with friends over Skype or Zoom or whatever, you know, whatever mechanism you use now. But on the same side, we look at if we get misinformation, if we're comparing ourselves to what, you know, the Smiths, quote unquote, are doing down the street, right? We're looking at that compounding piece of comparative negativity, I guess, where we look at, well, why aren't things going well for me? So we look at kind of that compounding piece. So boredom sets in. Do something different. Go back to what maybe you used to do before the screens were there, before we were stuck inside.
You know, one of the questions I want to ask you is that as restrictions are being lifted, people who have been isolated, who have missed being out in the open, being with their coworkers, are looking forward to going back to work whenever that happens. There are people, as you mentioned, who are introverts, who are more or less thriving being isolated because they don't have to go out.
Right.
What challenges may they face as these restrictions are being lifted and they have to return to work after being alone for so long?
Well, I think, you know, the natural anxiety that's going to be there, Steve, regardless, because there's that anxiety that comes with social connection for many introverts anyway. Some people have been able to compensate for that. But as we get comfortable in this new norm right now, we're going to fall again. That's kind of that falling back into those old behaviors or maybe those old habits where, you know, I can be on a Zoom call, but I can cover my camera. So I think the anxiety about going back and about what's it going to be like? I had an interaction with a reporter about what can workplaces do to help mitigate this. And again, here we come back to the information piece. If employees are aware of how this transition is going to occur, they can kind of start to take that in and we can do that ahead of time, right? So it's not just, hey, you're coming back tomorrow because we need a lead up time.
Stacey Hansen is a licensed social worker Stacey Hansen is a licensed clinical social worker with the RecoveryVillage.com, a company providing facilities and programs for helping addicts. And coming up later...
The United Nations says torrential rains and flooding have affected nearly 150,000 people throughout Yemen, causing serious damage to vital infrastructure and exposing thousands to potentially life-threatening disease outbreaks.
This is VOA News.
I'm Amanda Bennett, and I'm director of Voice of America, and I'm talking to you from my home where, like most of you, I'm quarantined because of the spread of the coronavirus. The coronavirus is one event that shows us more than ever why a free press matters. There's so much bad information, so much misinformation, so much disinformation that people all around the world are depending on us to give them factual information. And because of that, we are also depending on all the brave journalists all around the world who, perhaps in places that don't enjoy a free press, are still continuing to report on the truth about coronavirus in their country.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study that was presented at the American Geophysical Union's recent Ocean Sciences Meeting 2020 projects that between 70 to 90% of Earth's coral reefs will disappear over the next 20 years. The study goes on to suggest that factors like rising sea surface temperatures and acidic waters could destroy nearly all existing coral reef habitats by the end of the 21st century. The study authors also mapped areas of the ocean that they consider suitable for coral restoration efforts over the coming years. Renee Setter from the University of Hawaii, Manoa, who presented the new findings, says that the few sites possible for coral restoration by 2100 include only small parts of Baja California and the Red Sea. She adds that even these locations aren't ideal coral reef locations because of their nearness to rivers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. South Korea has protested to North Korea over the exchange of gunfire inside their heavily fortified border. Officials from the South say the North started it. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the details.
The first shooting inside the demilitarized zone in about 2.5 years, Seoul says several bullets fired from the north hit one of its frontline guard posts on Sunday before South Korean troops fired 20 rounds of warning shots in response. Defense officials say there were no known casualties on either side. The UN command says in a statement it's investigating if there had been a violation of an armistice that ended the Korean War. The 155-mile-long zone bisects the Korean Peninsula and is guarded by mines, barbed wire fences and combat troops on both sides. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
After 3 weeks of being out of sight, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un appeared in state media Saturday. VOA has not been able to independently verify the authenticity of the videos that have been released, but Mr. Kim's absence sparked reports of his ill health, speculation about succession, and more. Bruce Klinger is a senior researcher for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. I spoke to him via Skype to learn why reports of Kim's absence seemed to take on a life of their own.
Well, there are, I think, a number of factors. One is that despite our best efforts to get information on North Korea, it still remains a data black hole. When I was in the intelligence community, we called North Korea the hardest of the hard targets. And compared with when I worked the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union was an open book. So even for intelligence agencies, it's very difficult to get information, particularly on the leadership, intentions, the health, the location. Also, there's just a a sense that North Korea can be so easily satirized. I mean, we've all seen the cartoons and the movies and everything. And I think there just tends to be an inclination to go with what information you have because you have so little information. And then it often tends to be like the child game of telephone where you tell a story several times and it loses accuracy in the transmission. So we started with the one story about he had a heart procedure and he was recovering. And then all of a sudden that morphed into he's in grave condition and brain dead. And, he was dead from a failed missile launch to no, he's fine. And he's walking around the port city of Wonsan.
So Sunday, May 3rd was World Press Freedom Day and consumers of news around the world are asking sometimes great questions on how to get and discern bad information from good information. So like you said, North Korea is the black hole of information. There's not a lot to know about what's going on there in great detail. So how can people look at what's being printed or said on the radio or on TV and start to suss out details and make good informed decisions on what to believe and what not to believe?
Well, I think not only with North Korea, but really more broadly about reports that you read, even those that relatives send you, is, you know, if it seems really outrageous, it is less likely to be accurate than things that seem a bit more in tune with normal behavior. You know, what I noticed with this recent series of rumors was the longtime Korea watchers were those that were counseling caution the most. We tended to say, we don't know. We will likely have to wait either for a reappearance or an official announcement of his death. And that's because so many of us have gone through any number of false rumors about the death of not only Kim Jong-un, but his two predecessors or executions where the person then came back to life and resumed his position. So, you know, I think we were the ones saying, we don't know and just wait for it. And yet others were going with sources that they claimed were airtight or regurgitating stories, but then adding yet another layer of speculation. You know, I think a lot of the journalists who were reporting on sources that were had confirmed information, much of it contradictory to each other, you know, they need to do a bit of either a self-criticism session or do what intelligence agencies would do, which is go back and think of the sources and their reporting of why did they get it so horribly wrong, even though they claimed to have inside information? Was it the sources didn't have the access that they claimed? Are they just incredibly bad at analysis? Or are there sub-sources suspect? Or was there some kind of motivation either for the sources or for the journalists in providing that information?
Bruce Klinger is a North Korea expert with the Heritage Foundation here in Washington. Shares have taken a turn for the worse as tensions between the Trump administration and China over the origins and handling of the coronavirus pandemic have rattled investors. Benchmarks fell in London, Paris, and Hong Kong, while India's Sensex plunged nearly 6%. In the United States, key market indices were off at least 1% in early trading. Israel's Supreme Court is hearing arguments against the legality of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition deal with his former rival. The hearing comes a day after it deliberated on whether the longtime leader could head a government while under indictment for serious crimes. The court's ruling, expected by the end of the week, will dictate whether Israel breaks out of its prolonged political paralysis with Netanyahu and Benny Gantz joining forces in government, or whether the country is plunged into its fourth consecutive election in just over a year. The unprecedented live broadcast proceedings are also shaping up as a dramatic climax to Netanyahu's campaign against the Israeli legal establishment. Cameroon's military says it killed at least 22 separatist fighters in a week of raids on 7 rebel camps in the troubled western regions. Villagers, however, say the military killed at least 13 civilians in the raids, which involved at least 300 troops. The United Nations says torrential rains and flooding have affected nearly 150,000 people throughout Yemen, causing serious damage to vital infrastructure and exposing thousands to potentially life-threatening disease outbreaks. Lisa Schlein has that story.
UN agencies say the rains, which have been ongoing since mid-April, have damaged houses and shelters, rendering thousands homeless. They've washed out roads and bridges, contaminated water supplies, and knocked out electricity and other vital services. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says conditions are particularly difficult for thousands of families already displaced by conflict who have lost shelter, food rations, and household supplies. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA many people are at risk of getting ill or dying from disease outbreaks which thrive in flooded, unsanitary conditions.
Waterborne disease such as cholera or vector-borne such as malaria, because the stagnant water after the flooding is a breeding ground for mosquitoes. So getting rid of the water as fast as possible is very important. And of course, providing clean drinking water for the families who are there already.
Laerke says more than 110,000 cases of suspected cholera have been recorded across Yemen since January. Yemen's civil war, which is in its fifth year, has taken a heavy toll in lost lives and has shattered the country's socioeconomic structure. The UN says 80% of the population, or 24 million people, are in need of international assistance. It calls Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Looming over the existing calamity is the threat of COVID-19. Laerke says so far only 6 cases of the disease have been confirmed in the country.
But really, the setting there is almost conspire to make this into a disaster if we start seeing widespread communal transmission of COVID-19. One particular issue here is really there's massive funding problems in Yemen at the moment.
Laerke says the UN's humanitarian operation needs a significant boost in funding. Otherwise, he warns, many programs critical in combating COVID-19, such as providing clean water, sanitation, and access to health care, risk being shut down in coming months. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It is a morning of firsts for the United States Supreme Court. The first time audio of the court's arguments can be heard live by the world, and the first arguments by telephone. The changes are a result of the coronavirus pandemic, which has made holding courtroom sessions unsafe. The AP Supreme Court reporter Mark Sherman explains.
There are 6 justices who are 65 years of age and up, and that age group is, considered most at risk of getting seriously ill from the coronavirus. And that includes 2 justices in their 80s. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 87 and Stephen Breyer is 81.
The historic session began at its usual time of 10 a.m. when Marshal Pamela Tolkien called the court to order and Chief Justice Roberts announced the day's cases. Arguments, scheduled to last an hour as they normally would in the courtroom, got off to a smooth start. The court's plaza, normally bustling on the mornings of arguments, was deserted Monday, as it has been since the building was closed to the public in mid-March. 2 months of arguments were postponed before the court decided to hear 10 cases over the next 6 days. The experiment could propel the court to routinely livestream its arguments, or it could just be an extraordinary exception to the court's sustained opposition to broadening the audience that can hear, if not see, its work live.
Audio of the arguments is made available a few days after the arguments take place, but they've never been available live. The audio has never been available for anyone to listen to live.
Cases that will be heard over the next 2 weeks include President Donald Trump's effort to shield his tax and other financial records, and whether presidential electors have to cast their electoral college ballots for the candidate who wins the popular vote in their state. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, tablet, computer, or other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a magnificent Monday.